Hi everyone, welcome back. This is Rabbi Jeff Sachs of webyeshiva.org and Atid with the first of our second series on Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik's Halachic Man. In other words, we're picking up now where we left off in the previous semester, although we will give a quick summary and review. Now, for those of you that weren't with us, or those of you that are joining in now by the archives, in the chat box you'll see links to two different recorded shiurim. One is a general intro to Rabbi Soloveitchik's biography and thought. It's something that I had said a couple of years ago when we studied his Lonely Man of Faith, and I don't repeat that intro every time since many of you have been with us for previous series, but those that are interested in that kind of background are welcome to listen to that recording. And then there's also a link to the archives of all of the previous sessions that have led us through the introduction and first seven chapters of Halachic Man, those of you that would like to catch up. Those of you that are listening to this as an audio-only archive someplace and don't see the links because you can only hear and not see, those archived shiurim can either be found in the archives of webyeshiva.org, or they can be found in hosted by our friends at yutorah.org, where the MP3 archives are also located. And if you go to yutorah.org and search for my name, Jeffrey Sachs, you'll find all of those shiurim. And I've also put up into the box, of course, my email, Jeffrey Sachs, JeffreySachs at gmail.com. And of course, I welcome your feedback and input and questions and comments as we move along. And if anything is mentioned along the way and you'd like me to send it to you, I'm happy to do that as well. As I always mention, I always invite those of you that are either online with us live, and I see many of you mostly familiar names and faces, but why doesn't everybody just in the chat box say a little hello and just let us know where you're joining us from so everyone else can see? I remind you that in the chat box you can send to everyone, which is what you should be doing now, or send a message or a question privately either to me or to, you can pass the proverbial note to everyone else. You'd be welcome to do that as well. And then finally, just by way of introduction, I remind you that we have this cool little note feature in the upper right-hand corner of the WebEx screen. There's a little button for notes that opens a private notebook that you can keep and save whenever you'd like on your own computer, as opposed to the chat, which is obviously shared with other people. So there you go. This series, the entire series of for this semester, I'm not sure how many semesters it'll take us, but I'd be very surprised if we finish the work in this semester that'll be running us through the summer of 2014. This semester is dedicated in memory of Rabbi Ezra Labaton Zatzal, who was a very significant educator and thinker and communal leader in the Deal, New Jersey community, who was taken from us last year, tragically young. The series is dedicated by our student at Web Yeshiva, Michael and Tiffany Beta, in memory of Rabbi Labaton. If you visit that link that we've set up, webyeshiva.org/Rabbi Labaton, you will find other links to some of his shiurim and lectures and articles, some of which dealt with Rabbi Soloveitchik's thought as well, for Rabbi Labaton was a close student of Rabbi Soloveitchik, and our learning is dedicated in his memory, and our thanks to the Beta family for their dedication in memory of their great teacher, Rabbi Ezra Labaton. Halachic Man, here we are. The three main characters of Halachic Man that we've spent the last 39 pages of the essay, trying to analyze and understand. Rabbi Soloveitchik presents two typological characters. These are kind of pure figures. They're not necessarily meant to correspond to actual people that we know, although presumably there are such actual people in the world. One is cognitive man. In Hebrew, he's known as the Ish Hadat. The Ish Hadat. And Homo religiosus, who's known as the Ish Hadat. These are, I guess, handy a handy pun in the Hebrew. There you go. Da'at is knowledge, and dat. Let me just say that differently. Da'at is knowledge, and dat is religion. These are just homonyms if you mispronounce the proper Hebrew. Cognitive man can be thought of as the scientist, the person that approaches the world, not scientist in the sense that we talk about science, a conflict between science and religion. That's not what we're talking about here. But science as a way of looking at the world versus religion, the aspirations of the scientific man, the cognitive man, versus the aspirations of the religious man. The this worldly focus, a topic we're going to review momentarily, of the scientific man versus the otherworldly focus or the transcendental desiring of the homo religiosus, transcendental, the sense of trying to transcend, to leapfrog out of the bounds of olam hazeh, this world, into a more supernal, to use Rabbi Soloveitchik's phrase, spiritual realm. Both of these characters, the cognitive man and the religious man, are not the ideal that we aim for. And don't be confused, because obviously, Rabbi Soloveitchik wanted us all to be religious men and women. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a kind of distilled character who sees the world in a certain way, but not the ideal Jewish way or the way that Rabbi Soloveitchik would have said it, the ideal halachic way. Again, I'll just add a few of the caveats that I had laid down previously by way of review here. The word halachic, which means conforming with the halacha or conforming with Jewish religious law, is used here in a broader sense. Halacha both means literally the law, the way that we do things, the ritually prescribed manner of doing different mitzvot, but it can also have a kind of larger, more universal meaning, which is synonymous with the term that others might use for Jewish. The halachic man is the ideal Jewish worldview. So that halacha sometimes, or as I've said a few times, halacha with a lowercase h, the more specific meaning is the dinim, the laws. What is the halacha of someone who forgot to count Sfirat HaOmer tonight? But halacha with a capital H, writ large, is a synonym for the entirety of Jewish philosophy, Jewish thought, the Jewish worldview, the authentic Jewish worldview, which Rabbi Soloveitchik has identified and aligned with the halacha, because he believes that the halachic sources, principally the Talmud, but the entirety of the halachic Jewish rabbinic bookshelf, is itself the source of Jewish thought, as demonstrated quite ably in the pages so far. One other final caveat, when we talk about halachic man, cognitive man, religious man, remember the specific time frame in which the essay was formulated in the 1940s, and there's nothing about the gendered language here. which would limit these characters only to men and not to women. But the politically correct or gender sensitive notions that we have today were, of course, not there then, and we're not about to go back and revise the essay. So when we talk about halachic men, I now lay down the asterisk and the caveat that we're talking about halachic humans. I'm not going to follow Anne's suggestion that we change man to mon, but you get the idea. Let's go back and just do a quick review, and we're fortunate that the eighth chapter of the essay, or I should say the eighth chapter of part one of the essay is divided into two different parts. So we're in chapter 8 of part 1, which begins on page 39. I'll also remind you that that there is only one edition of the book, although it appears in different printings, paperback, hardcover, soft cover. But there's only internally there's only one edition. So whichever edition of the book you get, at least in the meantime, there's only one. There's only one page rep. All the page references will be the same, so it doesn't matter. And I really, really do recommend that you get a copy of the book. We put up links to different ways you can get it. So it's certainly a worthy addition to any Jewish library. Chapter 7 ended. The universal homo religiosus proclaims the lower yearns for the higher. But halachic man, with his unique mode of understanding, declares the higher longs and pines for the lower. So let me skip ahead and remind you of this little cheat sheet that we developed. There is, of course, the world of the material and the world of the spirit. There is, of course, this world, meaning the physical, created, material world that we all occupy, that we all live in, whose air we breathe, whose food we eat, whose stars we look out onto with wonder, but those stars are, in fact, part of our material, physical, created world. The cosmos, the universe, this is our world. Don't be confused by the childish notions that we had, and we should have been disabused of, that we live down here on earth and God is in heaven and heaven is up there, you know, on top of a cloud. No, the cloud is part of our world as well. And then there is the world of the spirit, the transcendental realm, the realm beyond our world, the world of religion, the world which God occupies. Okay. I'll just looking over the chats. Each of our characters, cognitive man, scientist, religious man, and halachic man, each of them approaches the spirit-material dichotomy in different ways. Cognitive man is only focused and interested in our world, the world which can be that can be observed, the world that can be measured. He is almost oblivious to the world of the spirit. Homo religiosus admits that we live in a material world. We are bounded and constricted by the physical realities of the world we live in, but yet he seeks to transcend it, to escape it, and reach the realm of the spirit. Halachic man, on the other hand, fully occupies this world, but wishes to draw down the spirit into the world. He knows we cannot transcend the world as long as we are alive, and this causes him to develop a whole variety of attitudes towards death, towards the next world, towards this world as well. And now chapter 8, which is very much a review, because after having laid out these different characters up until now, he's about to try to figure out how the tension, the inherent tension, which is built into the halachic man, being kind of pulled between this world and the next, between the world of reality, of creation, and the world of the spirit, how that can be resolved. So he takes a pause here, and I guess it's just fortuitous that we also took a pause here for a few weeks over Pesach. He takes the pause to kind of sum up, as it were, where we've been until now and what these different characters represent. At precisely this point, there appears the central antinomy that disturbs the consciousness of halachic man. The antinomy is the incompatibility, the contradiction, which is disturbing to him. On the one hand, as we explained above, his image resembles that of cognitive man, who occupies himself with, here at the top of page 40, intellectual constructions. On some plane, the halachic man is like the scientist. The halachic man is interested in looking at the world, examining the world, making sense of it, and then superimposing a kind of halachic understanding, or understanding the way in which the halachic reality underpins that of reality, but it is a this worldly focused, experiencing all the while the joy of discovery and the thrill of creation, and then coordinating his ideal intelligibles with the real world. If you recall, previously I many times used the example of the architect who looks at the building site, and can envision the structure that's going to go up, or who looks at the created structure and can, in his mind, deconstruct it, can see the pieces, can almost like with an X-ray vision see the different layers that are there. It's like we have a children's book that has, you know, with those, what do you call it, those, not cellophane, those plastic sheets where you lift up the plastic sheets to see underneath. It's a history of Jerusalem, and you can see by superimposing each of the plastic sheets with certain images painted on them, you can see how Jerusalem grew over the years, and then if you remove each sheet, then you go back to whatever the pristine, barren Jerusalem hilltops must have looked like 3,000 plus years before David HaMelech got there, before the Yebusim got there and built whatever was there beforehand. So the same kind of way, but it only takes place in your mind when you look at it, and that's that act of coordinating the ideal with the real, as does the mathematician. And yet, on the other hand, halachic man is not, I think the book is called Jerusalem, a Street View, or something like that, and it's available here in bookstores. It's actually in English, I think, although there might be a Hebrew version also. And yet, on the other hand, halachic man is not a secular cognitive type, unconcerned with transcendence and totally under the sway of temporal life. Again, I remind you, secular doesn't mean, although here the term can carry both meanings in this sense, secular doesn't mean non-religious, the way we colloquially use it. Secular means concerned with this world. The secular realm is the realm of this world. The religious realm is the realm of, don't get confused here with our notions of our eschatological notions, discussions about Mashiach and the world to come and the revival of the dead and all those kinds of things. We're not talking about this world versus the world to come. We're talking about this world, the created physical world, versus the kind of innerscape of the realm of the spirit. Halakhic man is not a secular cognitive type, as is cognitive man, unconcerned with transcendence and totally under the sway of temporal life. Olam hazeh. God's Torah is implanted in halakhic man's consciousness, both the idea of everlasting life and the desire for eternity. As the benediction preceding the reciting of the Torah states, B'chaye olam nata bitochenu, everlasting life is planted in our midst. God has planted everlasting life in our midst. That is the Torah. Halachic man is also a homo religiosus in all his loftiness and splendor, meaning he contains both of these elements within him. But because he contains both of these elements in him, there's this tension built into his personality. His soul too also thirsts for the living God, and these streams of yearning surge and flow to the sea of transcendence, to God who conceals himself in his dazzling hiddenness. This is a line from a zemer from Shal Shudas, El El Hamstater B'Shafrir Elyon. One verse states, the halachic man holds fast with all of his being to the concrete reality of our empirical world. One verse this, one verse that, third verse comes. This is a Talmudic construct or a Talmudic phraseology to explain thesis, antithesis, synthesis, that Hegelian dialectic is already present in Talmudic terms, but there it's we talk about shnei ketuvim hamachishim ze et ze ad sheyavo hakatuv hashlishi v'yachriya b'neihem, that you have one postulate, another postulate, and then a resolving, harmonizing idea that comes and settles the apparent contradiction. One verse states that halachic man holds fast with all of his being to the concrete reality of our empirical world. On one hand, halachic man is like cognitive man. On one hand, halachic man is like cognitive man. But the other verse states that halachic man reaches out to God and abides under the shadow of the Almighty. So on the other hand, he's like homo religiosus. He contains the multitudes of both of these very different characters. How can these two contradictory verses coexist? Sorry, let me just close this. The third harmonizing verse states, the only difference between homo religiosus and halakhic man is a change of courses. They travel in opposite directions. What are the two directions they travel in? Up and down. Halakhic man starts out in supernal realms and ends up in this world. Homo religiosus, dissatisfied, disappointed, unhappy with this world, craves to rise up from the veil of tears, from concrete reality, and aspires to climb to the mountain of the Lord. He attempts to extricate himself. He wants to escape. Religious man, homo religiosus, wants to escape this world. Because this world, the veil of tears, this world, Emek HaBacha, this world is a world of temptation. It's a world of compromise. It's a world where we are spiritual beings trapped in animal bodies that want to be fed, that want to mate, that need a roof over their head. And those things cause us to become distracted from the realm of the spirit. That's why in certain religious traditions, there's this kind of ascetic impulse which tries to negate physical needs, physical desires, to try to devalue them or to associate them with negative traits. That's not the authentic Jewish way. Rabbi Soloveitchik tells us and will tell us again and has reminded us in the past. So the difference between homo religiosus and halachic man is merely one of direction, to traveling the same highway but in different directions. So homo religiosus attempts to extricate himself from the narrow straits of empirical existence and emerge into the wide spaces of a pure and pristine transcendental existence. He wants the escape hatch. Halachic man, on the contrary, longs to bring transcendence down into this valley of the shadow of the death, that is, into our world, and transform it into a land of the living. Basically, homo religiosus is a romantic who chafes against concrete reality and tries to flee to distant worlds that will restore his spirit with their purity and pristine clarity. Now this footnote 46 here, all footnote 46 says is a reminder to look at footnote number 4. Now those of you that have been with us in the past, and if you're interested, you can listen to that intro session, the intro to Rabbi Soloveitchik's Life and Thought, which I linked to earlier, because there I talk about this footnote 4 at length. The fourth footnote of Halachic Man is almost a standalone essay. It runs for a number of pages, and it's a kind of description of homo religiosus, kind of contemporary to the time the essay was written, although it's still bearing today, to a kind of contemporary American religion, which is of course a predominantly Protestant brand of religion, although what he's talking about has great relevance to American Judaism, certainly mid-century American Judaism of 60 and 70 years ago, a kind of utilitarian attempt to say that religion will solve all of our problems, the idea that escaping this world and its temptations and its flaws and its problems, the tearing of the fabric already in the 40s, things, you know, 20 years ahead of what we generally think of as the things more connected with the 1960s, the breakdown of the family and all types of other cultural trends, the idea that religion will be the answer to all those problems, Rabbi Soloveitchik dismisses it out of hand. The idea that religion gives you all the answers to all of your questions is not the Jewish take on the purpose of religion. Au contraire, religion is the thing that gives you the questions that keeps you up at night searching for answers. Those are my words, not his, but that's his sentiment. So footnote 46 here is just a reminder of footnote 4. So if footnote 4 is at all fuzzy or unfamiliar to you, it's time to go back and take a look at that, and you can, of course, access it in the archives. Halachic man, however, takes up his position in this world and does not move from it. He wishes to purify this world, not escape from it. Flight goeth before the fall, a quote from the Gemara in Sota, Tchilat Nefila Nisa. Halachic man is characterized by a powerful stiff-neckedness and stubbornness. He fights against evils, against life's evil, and struggles relentlessly with the wicked kingdom and with all the hosts of iniquity in the cosmos. All these things that religious man wants to escape from, halachic man is busy doing battle with. I mean, he describes it almost like a knight of old. His goal is not flight to another world that is wholly good, but rather bringing down that eternal world into the midst of our world, our imperfect world. Homo religiosus, his glance fixed upon the higher realms, forgets all too frequently the lower realms and becomes ensnared in the sins of ethical inconsistency and hypocrisy. And here the Rav spells out for us what's wrong with religious man. And again, you would think, I mean, if you don't know anything about Rabbi Soloveitchik's thought, if you don't know anything about the purpose of this particular essay, you might think, yeah, Rabbi Soloveitchik, he's all for religion. But this character that he paints under that name is a flawed one. Now, again, it's a religious worldview which can be identified with certain streams in Christian worship and Christian religion, but it, of course, also exists within Judaism. It is a mistake to identify homo religiosus as mid-century Christianity. Much of mid-century Christianity could be aligned with it, but it is not exclusive to that. And again, there are elements in Judaism, both in the liberal denominations of Judaism, and again, parenthetically, I should state, we should be conscious of the background of when and where the essay is written. It's at a time when Orthodoxy in the United States is on the ropes. People are predicting that in a generation there will be no Orthodoxy in the United States. And that was not a crazy prediction. If you were a gambling man, that's where the safe money might have been. The fact that the exact opposite happened, that Orthodoxy became ascendant in the United States, it became the fastest growing movement, is not merely a function of birth rates. It has to do with a whole variety of things. The fact that the liberal denominations have had a historic downturn just on a demographic plane in terms of numbers is not only a function of intermarriage, although these things, birth rate and intermarriage, certainly play into it. So homo religiosus is a flawed character, because if you take his worldview to the full, you become ensnared in occasional ethical inconsistencies and hypocrisies. He's going to spell out what he means. See what many religions have done to this world on account of their yearning to break through the bounds of concrete reality and escape to the sphere of eternity. When you become too focused on the next world, it can become spiritually and ethically detracting. They have been so intoxicated by their dreams of an exalted supernal existence that they have failed to hear the cries of them that dwell in houses of clay, the sighs of orphans, the groans of the destitute. Had they not desired to unite with infinity and to merge with transcendence, then they might have been able to do something to aid the widow and orphan, to save the oppressed from the hand of the oppressor. This is an idea that Rabbi Soloveitchik expressed in different ways for different purposes, but that the idea that certain distraction from this world is can lead us away from our true purpose. You become so fixated on the next world, you tend to forget the fact that in this world there are some hungry people. And that energy that you're expending on the next world would both be better spent trying litakein olam, to repair this world, but it would also help you more likely enter the next world when it's time to get there. But all things in due course, and don't take your eye off the ball, and don't become insensitive to the true purpose of religion, which is to help the oppressed, to help the widow, to help the orphan, to do God's work in this world, to borrow a phrase. Don't be distracted from that while trying to figure out how to get to the next one. So the homo religiosus sometimes suffers from this ethical and hypocritical flaw, because so focused on the heavens, he becomes inattentive to his duties on earth. There is nothing so physically and spiritually destructive as diverting one's attention from this world. And by contrast, how courageous is the halakhic man who does not flee from this world, who does not seek to escape to some pure supernal realm. Halakhic man craves to bring down the divine presence and holiness into the midst of space and time, into the midst of finite earthly existence. I may or may not have mentioned this in the past, but I'm always reminded of Dostoevsky, the Grand Inquisitor. The Grand Inquisitor is a large section of The Brothers Karamazov, Dostoevsky's Russian novel, The Brothers Karamazov, but it's sometimes published as a kind of standalone book. You can sometimes get it just as a standalone book, and I presume that you can also get it online, both in translation and in the original Russian, if that's your thing. And it of course, working within a different religious tradition, but basically, it's an indictment of religious fanaticism. And what happens is that the Inquisition, which is a perfect example of an excess, of an ethical excess, of an ethical, a whole terribly flawed system, which was both a political but also a principally a religious system, in which all types of atrocities were committed in the name of religion. And what happens is that in the Grand Inquisitor, Jesus says to Torquemada, to the Inquisitor, you know, look at these terrible sins you've committed in my name. And Torquemada turns to him and says, yeah, maybe we should start making inquiries about you. Maybe you should undergo the tests of the Inquisition. You know, the satire, of course, being that, you know, religion will even turn on itself. Sooner or later, the cannibals will have to start nibbling at their own toes. You know, it's just in terms of world literature, a very powerful demonstration of what Rabbi Soloveitchik is talking about here, the excesses that religion has gone to in the name of religion. Halakhic man both differs from homo religiosus, who rebels against the rule of reality and seeks refuge in a supernal world, and from cognitive man, on the other hand, who does not encounter any transcendence at all. Halakhic man apprehends transcendence. In other words, as opposed to cognitive man, both halakhic man and cognitive man are focused in this world. In that way, they are the same. But there is one difference. Halakhic man recognizes the realm of the spirit and is just trying to bring it into our world. Cognitive man is oblivious to that world, if not directly hostile. So in some ways, halakhic man is like religious man. They both, of course, recognize the world of the spirit. They're just traveling in different directions. And in some ways, halakhic man is like cognitive man. They both affirm the primacy of the material world, of the created world, but they differ in their recognition of a realm, their acknowledging of a realm of the spirit. Halakhic man surely recognizes that, cognitive man is at best oblivious to it. Halakhic man apprehends transcendence, what cognitive man cannot do. However, instead of rising up to it, he tries to bring it down to him. Again, there's some repetition here, but bear with me. Rather than raising the lower realm to the higher world, halakhic man brings down the higher realms to the lower world. Halakhic man knows that there's no royal road, no Derech HaMelech, leading to the transcendent realm. Man's whole being is stamped with the indelible imprint of corporeality, concreteness, sensation. We are, in fact, beasts. We are, in fact, created beings. We're made up of DNA. When the scientists tell you that Homo sapiens share more DNA with chimpanzees than rats do with mice, We need not get our shackles up. On the contrary, that's proof of, to a believer, presumably, but that's proof of the power of the divinity which is within us. Because we are so similar to the beasts of the field in every other way. But yet, endowed with the divine image, are able to create society and civilization and a system of law and a body of world literature and a canon of music and an ethical code. That's proof of the difference. We are, in fact, corporeal. We're bodily. We're concrete. We live in the world of sensation. We experience pain and fear and hunger and desire and all the like. And halakhic man knows there ain't no way out of that as long as we live and breathe and walk this earth. Whither shall he go from their presence, and whither shall he flee from them? We can't escape it. Yea, and he waxes poetic here, yea, if he ascends to the heavenly existence, there will they be. Yea, if he takes the wings of the abstract and the supernal, there would their hand lead him. Halakhic man does not believe that one who is held captive in the prison house of bodily existence can free himself from all vestiges of material existence, can snap the fetters of the body and the yetzer and ride in his majesty through the skies. What homo religiosus would like to do, halakhic man knows it's impossible. And if, what he says elsewhere more explicitly, and if we are in fact created this way, that must be a sign that this is how God wants us to be. And if that's how God wants us to be, if the fact that we are created this hodgepodge, this shatnez of body and spirit, if this is how God creates us, and this is therefore somehow he wants us to be, that is the definition of being created in God's image. And more, halakhic man's religious viewpoint is highly exoteric, galui. Our worldview is one that is accessible, one that is communicable. It's not a secret. It's not some kind of, and here, of course, Rabbi Soloveitchik shows his pedigree as a descendant of the great rationalists. This is not a mystical worldview, although there are components of Kabbalah and mysticism at other points in the work, not here. Halakhic man's religious viewpoint is highly exoteric. His face is turned toward the people. The Torah, whether in terms of study or practice, is the possession of the entire Jewish community. And here we can remember the imperative of teaching, that the first prime obligation that the Jew has is to study, and to study means to teach. For the Rambam, of course, for Maimonides. Interestingly, for Maimonides, there's no mitzvah to teach Torah, which sounds quite counterintuitive, because for Maimonides, the mitzvah to teach Torah is the outcome of the mitzvah to study Torah. That if you've studied Torah, if you know some Torah, each person according to his level, each person according to his ability, if one knows Torah, you have an obligation to teach Torah. And ours is a teaching community, a teaching tradition, a learning tradition. That's the Jewish worldview. I'll skip ahead a drop, but he says, however, spiritual aspirations toward transcendence and fixing one's glance upon a higher world result in the religious worldview becoming a religious esotericism, which the halachic understanding of the world refutes from the outset. However, religious men, homo religiosus, focused on transcendence, focused on the heavens, leads away from exotericism, from the galui to the nistar, to the hidden. The generation has not yet arisen that is fit to serve God through the negation of concrete existence, through the casting off of the yoke of the senses in the body. We can't do it. It might be some kind of ideal for the world to come, but as long as we are in this world, we are human creatures bound by the body, and we have this obligation to live together in community, and we have this obligation to be teachers, to explain, to communicate. Therefore, any religious ideology that soars upon the wings of the Seraphim, the angels on high, and abhors mortal man, abhors flesh and blood, will perforce in the end, one, prove unfaithful to itself and be guilty of perpetrating a religious lie, as was stated above, and two, constrict itself to a narrow, dark corner, relinquish the public domain, give rise to a concept of religious esotericism, of hiddenness, of mysticism, of secret. The idea that there are high priests, that there are shamans who are privy to certain knowledge, and the hoi polloi has to go along. That is not the Jewish way. A religiosity that centers upon the heavenly kingdom and not upon the earthly kingdom, that can be made to reflect the heavenly. A religiosity that centers upon the heavenly kingdom and not upon the earthly kingdom, an earthly kingdom that can be made to reflect the heavenly kingdom, which is the goal of halachic man, gives rise to ecclesiastical tyranny, religious aristocracies, charismatic personalities. And there is nothing that the halakha loathes and despises as much as the idea of a cultic mediation or the choosing of individuals on the basis of supernatural considerations to be intercessors for the community. The thrust of halakha is democratic from beginning to end. Now that's a very significant statement. I want to pause on it for a moment before we end. A lot of people unfamiliar with halachic Judaism, unfamiliar with orthodoxy, but, you know, knowing only certain things that they read in blogospheres or hear in the news, would think that this is patently absurd. Halacha is democratic? Don't you have rabbis that tell you what to do? Don't you have rabbis tell you how to vote, how to dress, how to think? It's true. There are all types of excesses every hospital has its psychiatric ward. There are all types of excesses that one could point to in contemporary Jewry that would run counter to the ideal Rabbi Soloveitchik is pointing. The point he is making, although later he will parenthetically, on the next page I think, he will parenthetically make a comment about certain trends within Hasidut, where the Rebbe is viewed almost as a kind of intermediary, an idea he doesn't take to very kindly. But the idea that halakha is democratic principally comes from the notion, not the notion that we have that at a time when there was a Sanhedrin in Talmudic days, the way halakha was developed, was argued, was assessed, was determined, came through a much more democratic sense of people debating an idea, of voting on it, the majority ruling, acharei harabim lahatot. But even in our day, when the halakha is not determined exactly in that fashion, and we don't have rabbinic courts with a capital R and a capital C, as in the days of old, our rabbinic courts serve a different role today. Halakha is democratic in the sense that everyone has access to the knowledge. Everyone has access to the information. It doesn't mean that every single person becomes Rav Moshe Feinstein or Shlomo Zalman Orbach, but that the generation chooses the Rav Moshe Feinstein and the Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, in the sense that those are the names of two of the leading poskim, halachic decisors of the most immediate generation, both of whom, of course, have passed away. But in the United States, when I was a kid, Rav Moshe Feinstein was the first and the last and everything in between. He was the posek hador, at least in the United States, although, of course, his psakim, his halachic rulings about a wide variety of issues, had influence worldwide as well. He was, of course, the most qualified. He was, of course, the most knowledgeable. But he became the posek hador. He became the generation's leading halachic decisor of every weighty matter because his telephone rang more than the next person's. In other words, a rabbi's authority comes from his knowledge. But the rabbi's authority also comes from the fact that people follow him. There is no pope. The office of chief rabbi, whether the chief rabbi of the state of Israel or of communities or anything else, is not a real authority. In the sense parallel, you know, the pope is coming. Pope is coming to visit us next week. You can't compare the role that he plays in his religion with the role that chief rabbis play in ours. Ours is our authority, the authority that almost informal that poskim have is a very democratic one because the people, all of whom have access to the same information, there's nothing hidden. The people make decisions. The halakha declares that any religion that confines itself to some remote corner of society, to an elite sect or faction, will give rise to destructive consequences that far outweigh any putative gains. Even we who do have a notion of Kohanim, who served a ritual function in the temple, but the Kohanim were no more knowledgeable necessarily than the simple folk. They had a role, in temple service. They may have also had a role as teachers of Torah, but not the exclusive teachers of Torah. And the knowledge is all available to every single person. The religious ideology that fixes boundaries and sets up dividing lines between people borders on heresy. For religion declares that God is close to Reuven, is close to one guy, on account of his lineage, profession, or priestly role, and remote from Shimon, another guy, it is gravely culpable. No person, according to the halakha, needs the aid of others in order to approach God. A person needs no advocates or special pleaders. Every individual is assured by the halakha that whenever he will knock on the gates of heaven, they will be open for him. And in that regard, halakha is democratic. Everyone can get to heaven. Everyone can have access to knowledge. And even though it's true there are different roles that people play, there were functions that were done by some, principally in the Beit HaMikdash, that were not open to others, but that's got nothing to do with the larger democratic impulse, democratic in the sense of the people, that the people are all equal. They all have the same chance. We will continue next week. We'll pick up from here on the bottom of page 43. I hope that we'll finish chapter 8 next time, and then we will move on. I welcome your comments, questions, thoughts, etc. as we move along, and I'm glad to be back with you, and we hope to continue throughout the summer.